You're listening to Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and Friends, the number one source for travel news, reviews, and in-depth travel journalism, broadcasting live from Florida's Sun Coast on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Don't forget, you can listen to us online 24/7 at ttrn.com. And now, here's the travel guy, Roy Lowy.
Yes, and here is the travel guy, Roy Lowy, and I'm not alone today. I have a very special co-host today. It's Dr. Arlene Sullivan, world traveler and scholar. Good morning, Dr. Sullivan.
Good morning, Mr. Lowy.
And are you going to hang in here and kind of join in and have a little chat from time to time?
And maybe even a little bit of fun.
Sounds good to me. A couple of things. One, let's see who our guests are today. We have Mr. Evan Eggers, president of O2Cruise.com, Mr. Bill Wolf, president of Europe by Air, and Mr. Doug Dement, owner of OneBag.com. Mr. Ron Staub will be with us, and he's the director of Cruising America's Great Loop. Mr. Hans Tamamagi will do a Destination Canada with us. And we have Mr. Evan Eggers on the phone. Good morning, Evan.
Hello, Roy, and hello, Dr. Sullivan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And you had a great holiday, I assume.
Oh, I did. It was very good, very enjoyable. Relaxed, didn't do much.
Well, let's go to the cruise news. What's happening out there, Evan? There were a number of things. You know what? Let's start off with this unfortunate incident with Chalks, which ended up shutting down the port, I believe.
Yeah, that was terrible, of course. I feel badly for everyone involved in that. Really tragic. And although the airline, of course, it was very tragic for cruise passengers. It was merely an inconvenience in the grand scheme of things, where that plane actually went down right in the main shipping channel for Port of Miami. And so, not surprisingly, Port of Miami was essentially closed for a day. So the Royal Caribbean and Carnival ships that were scheduled to sail out on Monday, I believe it was, basically had to delay until Tuesday. And so the cruise line did what they normally do in such a situation. They offer people onboard credit. They tell them if they want to, they can cancel at a full credit. But, you know, under the circumstances, there weren't too many complaints, really, naturally.
Yeah, it was a terrible tragedy. But what was interesting is that it was really their first tragedy since, what, something like 1919, I believe.
Well, yeah, that's right. This airline, although people, you know, especially outside of the Florida area, probably haven't heard of Chalks Airways, it's a very reputable, been around forever, as you just mentioned. It has a fantastic safety record.
And, in fact, they say that he used to get on the airplane and he'd sit down and read his... He'd sit up front, and just in a plain open khaki shirt, and he would sit down there, open the newspaper, and say, "Boy, where is this pilot? Where, you know, if he doesn't show up pretty soon, I'm going to just fly this plane myself." And of course, all the regulars knew this, but the tourist got a little nervous, and one day he slams down the paper, gets up, walks in, "I'm not waiting for this guy any longer."
That's funny. I had not heard that
yeah,
story.
Yeah, cranked it up, and he was gone. So he was quite a character. There are a number of other things. Carnival is looking at some building some new ships, or refurbishing at least, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's a new ship. Carnival has gone shopping. They just decided, I guess, for the holiday season, they're going to go shopping for new ships. And they announced that they're going to be, Carnival Corp announced they're going to be building four new ships with Fincantieri, my favorite shipyard. I think the most beautiful ships come out of there myself.
That's, I'm glad you can pronounce that.
Very well. Am I pronouncing it right? I don't know.
You got me, but I think it's okay.
I do my best. So they announced they're building four new ships and optioning two more. And these ships, the new build themselves, are worth more than $2 billion. So for those of you who are keeping score at home, that means a new ship costs roughly $500 million each, which is...
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, that is. How do you guys bank and get a loan for that? I don't know, but...
I don't know. You have a lot of ships put up as collateral, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. So what's going on? Holland America is getting a new ship. Carnival itself is getting a new ship. Princess Cruise Lines and Costa, all, of course, owned by part of the Carnival Corp family. They're all getting one of these new builds each.
Right. So each of their cruise lines will at least have one new ship.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then Carnival also announced, and this is for people who are in the industry, they've heard a lot of scuttlebutt about this, Carnival is privately, you know, annoyed at all the kudos in the press that Royal Caribbean gets over, having the largest ship afloat, the Voyager class, before the Queen Mary was built, and now the Freedom of the Seas, which is coming out this year, of course, will be the largest ship afloat when it's launched. And I think Carnival is kind of annoyed at all this press Royal Caribbean's getting. And as a result, Carnival has had kind of not committed to, but talked about building the world's largest ship with what they call the Pinnacle Project, that would carry somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 people. they kept putting it off and putting it off, and it's still not firm, but they still say that they're considering doing it.
So, you know, all this one-upsmanship is something else, isn't it?
Well, there is, and it's kind of like, you know, I think it's kind of a good-natured competition and tweaking of each other that they do. So we'll see if Carnival comes up with this at some point and makes it a firm order in the future.
Now, there was one other item here I thought was interesting, and is the report about the from the Bahamas Maritime Authority on the Norwegian Dawn.
Well, that's right, and this is actually, so the Bahamas Maritime Authority had said some time ago that they found that the Norwegian Dawn's rogue wave incident, this is in April, when the Norwegian Dawn sailing northbound back to New York from the Caribbean was hit by a rogue wave that caused some injuries, it caused some damage to the ship, broke some windows, and the Bahamas authority had said that they had found that Norwegian had acted properly, but now the American authority, the National Transportation Safety Board, has finished their investigation. They just announced the result, and they also cleared Norwegian, saying that the ship's crew, the staff, acted properly. And of course, there had been some little small media frenzy over the fact that the ship, had it arrived back in New York on time, which it did not, but had it arrived back in New York on time, it would have been featured on the TV show The Apprentice. So kind of the media scuttlebutt was, well, were they rushing back on safely to get there in time for The Apprentice? And the NTSB said they did not. They slowed the ship down intentionally. They knew they weren't going to make it back to The Apprentice no matter what, and tried to operate in as safe a manner as possible.
Right.
And that it really was an unpredictable, as rogue waves are, an unpredictable event that they did their very best with.
Exactly.
So I'm sure Norwegian is happy about that.
Well, that's good news, actually.
Yeah.
There was another item, and probably, if we can, I'll probably wind it up on that, is they've opened the new Brooklyn passenger ship terminal, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. The terminal will officially open on April 15th, the Brooklyn passenger ship terminal, because the west side of Manhattan, those cruise ship piers were kind of overloaded with, many ships now calling in New York that hadn't before and being homeported there. So the Queen Mary II will be homeported in Brooklyn, and it will officially open the terminal in Brooklyn on April 15th when it arrives. And then, of course, it'll be homeported there going forward. So that's pretty exciting. And from that Brooklyn terminal, you've got a view of the Manhattan skyline, you've got a view of the Statue of Liberty, you've got a view of the Brooklyn Bridge. So that'll be a great facility, and I can't wait to see it myself and go check it out.
And the date set is April 15th.
April 15th, that's right.
When the
QM2 will first arrive, that's right.
Evan, once again, thank you very much. We're going to do a pre-recorded show because we're going to be on the road next week. So we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Oh, you're so generous with my vacation time. Such a kind boss you are, Roy. I appreciate that.
You're one of our favorites, Evan. So.
Well, have a great show, and Dr. Sullivan, you have a great show, too.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Evan Eggers, and always a pleasure, and he's always got some great information for us. This segment is brought to you in part by USA 3000 Airlines, offering low-cost fares from St. Petersburg, Fort Myers, Fort Lauderdale, Chicago, O'Hare, Cleveland, Newark, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Detroit, and Pittsburgh. Isn't it time you tried USA 3000? And we'll be right back.
Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks. All-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today.
You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah. Yeah, with a little of that merengue music, we're going to bring on Mr. Bill Wolf, president of Europe by Air, and he's on the phone. Good morning, Bill.
And good morning, Roy.
How are you this morning?
Oh, fine. California weather's beautiful today. It's nice and cool. Yes, that's why, of course, you're in Florida, so I better not say too much about California, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it's been chilly here in the morning. You went over to London for the World Travel Mart. Just give us a little background. What's happening out there? Do you get any feeling, any real new stuff? What's going on?
Well, I guess what... What I found is how resilient this travel business really is. You know, After 9/11, it was a huge decrease in the number of travelers for hotels, for airlines, and everything else. Of course, now we're years away from that, but what was amazing is still how many new airlines are constantly getting started throughout Europe.
New startups, you mean, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, just huge numbers. Even yesterday, I just found a few more I hadn't heard of, and I was only in London in November for that show.
Well, in fact, you've added a new one. I think we've mentioned that before to your network, and it's a Swiss one, is it not?
Yeah. They're based in Lugano, Switzerland, which is just on the southern side of Switzerland, right near the border of Italy. They fly from London City Airport, a great little airport. They fly into Bern. They fly into Lugano. Bern, of course, is in the German section of the northern part of the Alps. They fly into Geneva, which is in the French section, and then they also fly down into Rome. So it's a nice little airline. They have a couple of frequencies for people going to London and into Rome. I like the airline a lot. And I think what I really like about it, because when I get to Europe, I travel around to try to visit all my airlines as well. And flying from London City Airport. This is a little airport.
Yeah, tell us more about that. London City Airport is I think it's a little bit of an unknown commodity to some. And tell us more about London City Airport. That's good.
Well, it's probably my absolute favorite airport over there. London City is to what we call the east end of London. It's called the Docklands. They've done a lot of development out in that area. The other airports, Gatwick and Heathrow, are either to the south or to the west. But this is really a city airport. It's only probably 20, 30 minutes away from what the main area of London is, which is called the West End, where the tourists go for shopping and hotels and stuff like that. And the nicest thing about it is it's available now by tube or subway with connections straight to the airport. And the airport is very small. I use it a lot to fly throughout Europe, and I can take the tube there. And then your lines are like three. I don't think I've ever been in a line longer than about four people to check it. In fact, they say you can really do it in 20 minutes, but I'd give it a little more time than that.
Now, how many airlines would you say are operating out of there at this time?
There's probably 10 or 15 total. I probably got at least a half a dozen of those already in the program.
Right.
You can go through security incredibly fast. And then once you clear security, there's a nice lounge, and it's not plastic chairs. It's nice leather chairs. It's a short walk to the planes. And even coming back in, it's amazing. You're coming in from the continent. The lines going through customs and immigration are so short, you almost walk straight through. It's
so security goes quick. All of those things go, faster than usual.
They're really promoting that airport a lot. Like I say, I really like it.
Well, what's new with the Europe by Air?
That is our newest airline. Just a couple months ago, we added another one called I better say OLT because it's in German and it's Österreichisch.
Yeah, they're a little hard to pronounce. You know,
Frankfurt or something like that. That's right. But they fly from Bremen, and they just. They just sent me an email over the holidays. They started a new service from Bremen, which is northern Germany, of course, up to Bristol, which is near Bath, and the south of England, like the Cornwall area. And they also started a new flight down in Toulouse, which is where the Airbuses are made. And then in southern Germany this year, I also had DVA. They're based in Munich, and they joined the program. And I've got on the horizon at least another 20 or 30 airlines to start talking to, and it'll all start happening in 2006.
All right, and even with the new low fares that these guys come out with in the beginning and sort of play around with, I'm sure that are highly capacity controlled, the pass still works well with the $99 legs, right?
Well, that's the key to it, and that's how what attracts these airlines is. It's just everybody's got some low fares, but in reality, these are a little hard to find. And what I tell the airlines is, individually, you can't really sell that to Americans because you don't have enough of a route structure. So what I do is, so you just join our group, and on our on our network map, you can see all the possibilities.
Right.
So it's $99 per flight, but my gosh, some of the flights are so long, you could go from Oslo to Athens for two $99 fares at $198, and if you tried to buy that from a regular airline, you'd be talking hundreds, if not over $1,000.
And you're guaranteed it at 99, whether you,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
so that's the biggie.
That's right.
As where the other fares tend to change. Well,
absolutely.
Bill, thank you. It's always a pleasure, and we hope to be talking to you soon. We got to run. We got to go to break and try to make a couple of bucks.
Okay, Roy. Thanks for the call.
Okay, Bill. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, Bill Wolf, EuropeByAir.com, a great commodity, great map, great interactive map. So when you get a chance, have a look. We got to go to break, and we'll be right back.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
We're now joined by Mr. Doug Dement, the owner and author of OneBag.com. And good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
And are you well this morning?
I am indeed, yes.
Now, let me ask you. First of all, I want to tell you, it's a super site. I just love it. The information is great. And, you know, when I was going through it, I thought, if the art and science of traveling light would have been offered as a school subject, I think most of us listening probably would have failed. And as you point out on your website, there are many reasons to travel light. Tell us about the principal ones, if you will.
Well, as you point out, there are lots of good reasons for doing it. It depends on the person. The main one is security. You get to hang on to your bag. You don't watch it disappear down a chute somewhere or into some random person's hand and wonder if you'll ever see it again. So you're not likely to lose it to theft or to damage or being sent to the wrong airport or anything along those lines. It tends to be less expensive if you're carrying your own bag. It's something you can just deal with yourself. You don't have to pay airport people to carry it and move it and store it for you. You are more likely to be able to easily jump on a bus or something rather than taxis. You can even walk. and you just have a lot more mobility. You don't have to get to the airport quite as early. You don't have to worry about what's going to happen to your bag if you take a different flight or you try to get on an earlier flight. You can jump on trains and things without worrying what's going to happen to your bag because it's right there with you, all of that kind of stuff. So I guess those are the main reasons.
So amongst other things, we've got security, economy, mobility. Now, how do we get started? I mean, how do we start to travel or psych ourselves or retrain ourselves to travel and pack light?
Well, absolutely the single most important thing is that anybody who's traveling at all, you know, more than once or twice in their lives, should create and maintain a packing list. That's the one big secret. There are lots of little tricks and lots of things you can do, but bottom line, if you do one thing, it's have a list. Don't just make it up in your head every time the night before you're going to go somewhere and pull things randomly out of the closet and say, well, I might need this. You should have a list.
Or have to go back to your bag and say, did I put those warm socks in there?
Exactly. Yep. I mean, the list does a couple of things. First of all, because you sort of hone it over time, It just means that you don't take stuff that you don't really need. But the other thing is as you point out, it reminds you of something you may have forgotten. I mean, my own list, which I've been using for years and years, as you can well imagine, I probably don't need the list in theory. But just like the airline pilot uses his list every time when he's checking the plane before flying, I check my list every time. And it's more than one time that I've discovered that, oh, darn, I didn't pack a belt. And I would have been stuck somewhere with a pair of dress trousers and no belt for it, if I hadn't looked at my list.
Exactly. And you know, I'm going to do a trip. We've been invited up to do the show up at in Quebec for the Winter Festival, which should be wonderful. And so, I mean, living in Florida, and I'm digging out all of these warm clothes, and I'm putting them in a duffel bag. So I figured, let me throw all of that in the duffel bag. And then, but I didn't have a list. And then I suddenly thought, wait a minute, did I put those warm gloves in there? Now I'm unpacking all over again.
Sure.
To look. So you're absolutely right. The checklist is the way to start.
Yep. And speaking to your temperature traversal, you're much better to deal with temperature variations by doing layering, not by thinking of what's the warmest coat I own, what are the warmest socks I own, all of that sort of thing.
Good point.
The list I use doesn't include a particularly heavy garment, and yet it has, I don't know, off the top of my head, I'm going to say about six layers that it will provide for insulation, and that's much more efficient than just putting a giant coat on top of everything else.
Yeah, or the, I guess the alternative to that with a heavy coat would be to carry it with you.
Sure, yes, certainly if you are taking a really heavy thing, like a heavy pair of boots or a heavy coat or something, that should be the item you're wearing, not the item that's taking up half your suit.
Exactly.
Hey, Doug, it's Arlene. Do you find that women have a tendency to pack more things than men do?
Well, I mean, there's this urban myth, I think, that women don't know how to travel light. I certainly get more letters from husbands saying that if they could only teach their wives how to do this, then the reverse. But I'm not really convinced that's true. Women tend to be really good at, I guess, what I'll call accessorizing. Women tend to have a really good feel for, with just three or four different things, putting together a variety of different looks. And that's something that stands you in really good stead when you're trying to travel out of one small suitcase. So you know, I think women have advantages over the men in some areas of.
We just have a lot more shoes.
Yes. You need to cut back on the shoes in person. That's for sure.
Now you make an interesting point on the website that you say the information on one bag is not particularly directed at campers and backpack hikers. This is directed to the travelers in general.
Yes. Yeah, I mean that's where my experience is. I haven't done a lot of serious backpacking and hiking. I've read books on it. I know what those folks do, but I can't bring personal expertise to that. But in terms of just getting on airplanes and buses and trains and cars and traveling all around the world, I've been doing that for 40-45 years, I guess, and so I have a lot of personal experience I can bring to that, and I can usually answer people's questions. But the truth is, much of the same thought process goes into both modes of travel. You know, how can I eliminate things? How can I make things that I take serve more than one function? How can I find a lighter, smaller version of something? So a lot of it is very similar. But I don't address things like tents and sleeping bags and all that kind of stuff.
Now, the other thing is, do you find that there's any one particular item that people tend to take with them that's not necessary, that you probably don't ever use, but you always feel you need to have it with you?
No, I don't think I could put my finger on a specific item. It's always usually just too much of stuff.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Instead of taking three shirts, they take eight shirts because they don't know what shirt they're going to need. And, well, they might, you know, need a different color or something. That's another trick, by the way, to traveling efficiently, is to think about color schemes. Think about, you know, like one or two basic colors, and everything you take with you on a specific trip should be in one of those two colors. And that pretty much guarantees that everything goes with everything else.
Right. Right, that's an important point. Now, can I was really pleased to find this site, and could you just kind of walk us through your site, if you will?
Well, it tends to be a small number of large pages. There's an overview page that sort of sums up the philosophy and says a little bit about where the site came from and what its intent is. And then probably the most important page is a page called What to Take, which is an extensive analysis of my own personal packing list, suggesting that it would be something that somebody might want to start with to develop one of their own. And it just goes into exhaustive, some would say exhausting, detail on all the different items on the list and what they're there for and what the thinking behind them is. And that's definitely the longest page. There's a lot to read there. And then there's another fairly extensive page that talks about baggage, the ideal bags for different kinds of trips. And I mention a variety of bags that I found useful. I rush to say that this is not a commercial site, so I don't get any kind of commission for any of the things that I talk about.
That was a good point to make, because people tend to think that even in this, in the broadcast industry, that we're led by commercial factors. When on the show, we really consider it journalism, and we put, what we put out there is there's a good reason for it, not because somebody's advertising.
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the main reasons for the popularity of my site over the years is that once you get into it and start reading it, it's pretty clear that this is just a person's opinion and it's not tied to any commercial thing. Anyway, then there's another page on how to pack things, lots of little tricks of packing, and maybe the most important trick of all is a way of folding clothing so that it doesn't wrinkle, which very few people seem to know how to do. There are lots of urban legends about how you're supposed to pack clothes, and most of them are either ineffectual or worse than doing it what you would have probably done intuitively. So
yeah, I'm not a good
I talk about that a lot. And then there are sort of three remaining pages on just sort of summaries of information. There's a resource page that attempts to point people to places where they can find the things that I talk about. I talk about special kinds of clotheslines that travelers use, and of course certain kinds of bags and that. So I try to provide access for that. Then I have a library page where I list not very many, maybe half a dozen or so books that I think are worth reading if you want to get more into it. And then there's just a sort of links page where I've collected together links to various sites that I myself make use of and think that anybody who's interested in my site would probably find them interesting as well.
Well, the question that comes to mind, I think, with a lot of our listeners is, how did you get this all started?
Well, It's probably a longer story than we want to include in a short segment.
Well, we've got 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, it started, I mean, I'm in the computer business, the technology business, so I was in the internet in the late 60s before most people even knew it existed. And in the old days, there was something called, mailing lists, and people would share information about stuff. And because I traveled a lot, I found I often was responding to people who were saying, what kind of a bag should I use for such and such kind of traveling? Or, what do I need to take with me on a trip? And so both of those two responses kind of grew into short little standard articles that I would send out. And then around the mid-90s sometime, I don't remember exactly when, but when the web was coming alive and people were starting to build websites, I figured that I really needed to learn how to build websites, and so I just needed a topic, something, an excuse to put together a website, mostly just to teach myself how to build websites. And I thought, well, people are always asking me about this packing stuff, so maybe I should do that. So that's how it started, and it's been 10 years now, and it's grown steadily, and I get something on the order of about 1,000 to 1,200 visitors a day on the site, so it's fairly popular.
If it had a high Google rating, I think you were up around a 6 or a 7, in fact.
Yeah, it gets a lot of traffic, and it grows slowly. I mean, I do tend to it. I do keep an eye on the information, and because some of it changes. I mean, in fact, I think it's happened already. About 4 days ago, they've started to let people carry scissors on airplanes again.
Yeah, exactly.
So little things like that you just sort of have to keep on top of and make sure you're giving the right information still.
Well, the name of the site is onebag.com, and it's a great site. We suggest to everyone check it out. And, Doug, thank you for joining us, and maybe we can get together another time, and we'll keep our eye on it.
You're most welcome. Glad you're interested.
Thanks. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Well, that onebag.com, you've got to check it out. It's really an interesting site, and Doug's passed along some really good information to us. When we come back, Ron Staub, director of America's Great Loop Cruises Association, and some interesting stuff will be with us when we get back. So stay there.
John Native, totally playful. Totally never tried that before. Totally Club Med. Introducing the new Total All-Inclusive Club Med with unlimited drinks, all-day dining, world-class accommodations, 64 sports and activities, all gratuities and more for a totally great price. So you can totally forget your wallet. Call today for a totally unlimited, totally together, totally barefoot time. Book now and save on a 7-night total all-inclusive vacation to Club Med in the Caribbean, Bahamas, or Mexico. Call today. You'll totally want to do it again. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're back, and we're joined by a very interesting gentleman, Mr. Ron Staub, and he is the director of the American Great Loop Cruises Association. And Ron and his wife, Eva, are the authors of Honey, Let's Get a Boat. Now, Ron was a columnist for a California newspaper for 15 years and is the author of three books on travel along California's Central Coast. And thank you for joining us, Ron.
Yes, glad to be here, Brian.
It's my understanding that your organization is made up of boaters who have cruised or dreamed of cruising any of all of America's Great Loop. Can you share that with us? Because I think there are a lot of people that are really not familiar with the Great Loop, and of course it certainly sounds fascinating.
Well, the Great Loop is the circumnavigation of eastern North America. It could also be called the Great Circle. It could also be called the inside passage of eastern North America. It's a fairly enclosed waterway using the intercoastal waterway on the Atlantic side through rivers and canals and the Great Lakes and then down the rivers back to the Gulf of Mexico. It's usually done in a counterclockwise direction, beginning in the south in the spring, Florida, for example, getting into Chesapeake Bay around May, getting to New York around June 1st, and then spending the summer in Canada, coming back through the Great Lakes down to Chicago in September, and then down the rivers back to the Gulf Coast around November.
Now, how did you get started in all this?
Well, we had a curiosity about the Trent Severn Waterway about 10 years ago, so we chartered a single-screw faw tug. That's a little boat with a single propeller, and four of us bopped around on the Trent Severn Waterway. This is a historic canal in Canada,
right,
built between 1850 and 1920. And we did about 40 locks in that two-week period. And then we got off the boat, and along the way, my wife saw a big white trawler at Bob Cajun, and he was from Virginia. And it said Virginia on the transom, and she said, "And how did you get here from Virginia?" And he said, "By way of the Mississippi and the Illinois River." Well, that made us begin to think about the geographic connections between Virginia, all of those waterways. He had to go south to Florida, across Lake Okeechobee, up the panhandle of Florida, and so forth. And then he got into the waters of the Great Lakes and into the Trent Severn Waterway. And then we became familiar with this circumnavigational route called the Great Loop. So we got home, and Eva said, "Isn't that fascinating?" And I thought it was kind of fascinating, but not as fascinating as she thought it was. And the house began to fill with books on boats and then magazines, and then we began taking courses with the United States Power Squadron because she had the ambition to do this on our own boat. And she is the person who said, honey, let's get a boat and cruise the Great Loop.
And that's where the book came from.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, we're in the Sarasota area, and coming across Lake Okeechobee, you come out and into the Fort Myers area, is really quite interesting. And then to head up the intercoastal, at what point do you get into the river part of it? That's the part that I'm a little...
Normally this trip is done counterclockwise, beginning in the south, going north on the Atlantic side, the Atlantic ICW, into the Great Lakes and down the rivers in the fall. If you were in Florida, for example, with a boat and lived in Michigan and you wanted to take your boat back to Michigan, the short route would be back up through the rivers. That Mobile, you'd catch the 10 Tom, which goes into the Tennessee at Yellow Creek, Pickwick, then the Tennessee River into the Ohio into the Mississippi into the Illinois into Lake Michigan. But that's going against the current, and in springtime, those rivers can run. And if you have an 8-knot trawler doing going against 6 knots of current, that's 2 miles per hour, you could in one day travel 25 miles. So this is always a precarious, uncertain situation for people going up the rivers.
Right.
The benefit of doing it counterclockwise is you get off of the Atlantic eastern coast before hurricane season begins. You're in New York by June 1st. Hurricane season hasn't yet begun. You go down the rivers with the current, going with the flow in the fall, and you get back into the Gulf of Mexico around November 1st, which is pretty much the end of hurricane season.
And that certainly saves you a lot of gas than fighting the other way, if you're in a powerboat.
Surely does, yes, of course. That will be the advantage, staying off of the East Coast during hurricane season and going with the flow.
Ron, do you go through the St. Lawrence Seaway?
The St. Lawrence Seaway, if you take a direct route from New York up into Lake Champlain on the New York Champlain Canal,
right,
and then catch the Chambly Canal at the end of Lake Champlain,
right,
you're now in Quebec, you end up in the St. Lawrence Seaway at Sorel.
Okay.
From that point, you can go downstream, out to sea, to Quebec City, and Tadoussac, and up the Saguenay Fjord to Chicoutimi, or you could go upstream to Montreal, which is the designated Great Loop route, and spend some time in Montreal, then take the Ottawa River to Ottawa, then do the flight of stair step locks to the Rideau Canal,
wow,
and travel south to Kingston. So that's how much you're in the St. Lawrence Seaway. When you reach Sorel, you are in the St. Lawrence Seaway, then you go up to Montreal, then you leave and go take the Ottawa River, or you can go upstream on the St. Lawrence River to Kingston and pick up the Trans-Severn Waterway. But you need to clear a 17-foot fixed bridge on the Champlain Canal, so this is not a route that everyone can take.
Right.
Larger boats with a lot of air draft have to opt to use the Erie Canal to Oswego and then enter Lake Ontario from that point, and then either go down the St. Lawrence Seaway again to Montreal or go across Lake Ontario to the Trans-Severn Waterway and skip the Rideau, which is not a good idea because the Rideau is fascinating and the city of Ottawa and Montreal are some of the most interesting places to visit along this route.
While you're on that, tell us about some of your favorite experiences and destinations along the way, if you will.
Well, because of our first experience was on the Trans-Severn Waterway, we think that this is one of the most interesting places to visit, and we have revisited again in a tradable boat. The Trans-Severn has a lot of different kinds of locks. This waterway was developed in 1850, finished in 1920, so it has gone through a number of different changes in engineering. There are conventional lift locks. There are hydraulic lift locks with counterbalance tubs, such as at Peterborough and at Kirkfield. And then there's the marine railway. All of these are really fascinating things to do in a boat, small or large. Other destinations are the North Channel and Georgian Bay. There are beautiful anchorages in these waterways. This is all oligotrophic water, channeled, glaciated waters, very clear water, very hard bottoms, granite bottoms, beautiful anchorages, such as in the Benjamin and Croker Islands. And then the Tennessee River. Once we got on the Tennessee River, we were living in California when we did this trip. We were struck by its beauty. And now we live here on the east, on the Little Tennessee River near Knoxville. The Tennessee River is very pretty. Chattanooga is a fascinating river town of about 400 miles, 300 miles up the Tennessee River. And then there are so many favorite, interesting, historic towns along the way. Fort Lauderdale, where we began, is an interesting place to visit and be. Savannah, Georgia, a fine museum city. Charleston, South Carolina, beginning of the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. Baltimore, New York, and the Canadian cities of Montreal and Ottawa. Mackinac Island, which doesn't have any vehicles. In 1903, they forbade vehicles, so it's just all horses. They've got three veterinarians for 600 horses and one family physician. It's just a lot of manure and fudge and interesting places to visit. And the port cities of Michigan, coming down the down Lake Michigan, are just really fascinating places to stop.
Now, you mentioned an interesting thing, anchorages, because, you know, one has a nice cabin boat. As we all know, we put in a lot of gas in our boats to push a cabin around that sometimes we don't get to use very often, and a lot of these destinations don't have anchorages. You need to go into a marina or something like that. So I think that's an interesting point. Did most of these places have anchorages?
Well, if you get good guides, Waterway Guide, for example, and guides written by Claiborne Young, Fred Myers, and these kinds of guide writers, Skipper Bob, they have anchorages included in their guides, and you can find them if you're looking for them. And many places, like the Tennessee River, for example, has numerous places to anchor.
Uh-huh.
So there's a lot of little gunk holes to get into, and our experience has been that a mediocre anchorage is usually a far better experience than even the best marina. The advantage of going to a marina is that you can get off on land, you can visit, you can go out to dinner, and you can see other points of interest along the way. And if you've taken bicycles along, like we have, many boaters do, that's your principal means of transportation, and it gives you a chance to get on land and exercise. And if you've got pooches and cats, you know, that's the way to get your animals to shore as well. But anchorages are really delicious experiences. They are nature's best. You're alone. You're away from the hustle of the city. Seeing America from the water's edge is just a really unique experience, and the anchorages provide some of the most beautiful, quiet moments. And it's cheaper. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything to drop a hook. Staying in a marina may be a dollar a foot, could be less, could be more. But if you have a 40-foot boat like we did, that's $40 a night just to stay at some marina. It doesn't cost a thing to stay at an anchorage. And we had some problems with the boat. We were kind of on a budget. Most people are. So anchorage has become a good alternative.
Absolutely.
You're traveling with other boaters. You tie together. You raft together. You drink and eat together. You play together. It's just a really nifty experience.
I couldn't agree more. There's one interesting note for our audience. If you'd like to meet the authors of Honey, Let's Get a Boat, I understand you'll be at the Miami International Boat Show February 16th through 20th. Is that correct?
We certainly will. Uh-huh.
And you're in booth number 2555.
2555. I think that's correct, yes.
And
we're next to Boaters World. They have a large room there, and we're in there with them. We're also in there with the 10-Tom Waterway people. So if anybody needs information on the Great Loop, we will be glad to impart that.
Ron, thank you very much. It was very informative, and I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot, and they're probably all now out there swabbing down the decks, setting their boats up for the great the great circle route.
Incidentally, we're having a little problem with the website at this point, www Great Loop, but it's a work in progress. We'll have it up in good shape in a day or two.
I checked it out yesterday. It was fine.
Very good.
But listen, thank you once again. We'll talk to you again. We've got to go to break.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye for now. Well, that was kind of interesting. I, you know, being a boater, I'd never thought about traveling quite that far. But, you know, you need to have the time, you need to have the patience, and you need to have the know-how. And good sight. Good book. I think we'll have him back at another time when we get a chance to look at the book, and we can review some of that. But right now, we're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Mr. Hans Tamamagi, and he will be doing another Destination Canada. So stay with us.
USA 3000 Airlines knows the way. USA 3000 now flies to and from Fort Myers, St. Petersburg, Clearwater, and Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, servicing 11 different cities, all at our same low fares starting at $59. No peanuts served here. For a low fare with a real meal and in-flight entertainment, choose USA 3000. USA 3000 has simple fare rules regardless of the fare. There are no Saturday night stays and no round trip required on any fare. They have a low change fee, and this is the part you're really going to love. Even if you miss your flight, you don't lose your fare. So what are you waiting for? With fares this low and rules this simple, you can afford to take someone with you. Call now to make your reservations at 1-877-USA-3000. That's 1-877-USA-3000. You can also book online at www.usa3000.com or call your local travel agent.
We're back, and we're being joined by travel journalist Hans Tamamagi and another Destination Canada report. Good morning, Hans.
Good morning, Roy. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Always a pleasure. You always share such great information with our audiences, Hans. It's great to have you back. We always look forward to the next version.
Well, you know, Roy, I can't tell you how excited I am about today. Parliament Hill in Ottawa, Canada, holds a really special place in my heart, and I'm just dying to talk to you about it and, you know, describe it to your listeners.
Well, you know, your article is titled Parliament Hill, the Heart and Soul of Canada, and in your opening sentence you say, on Canada Day, there is no place I'd rather be than in Ottawa amongst the exuberant crowd on Parliament Hill.
Well, I think that sums it up. On Parliament Hill on Canada Day is the one time when we Canadians let loose and actually show some of our nationalistic fervor. There are crowds. There's about 500,000 people crammed into Parliament Hill and the surrounding streets. There are buskers. There are bands. Everybody's wearing red and white. The people have tattoos on them and the Canadian flag. And everybody is smiling and happy. It's just a delightful time.
And you say you get about, you know, approximately 100,000 people during this this celebration.
There's 100,000 just on Parliament Hill itself, and there must be another almost 500,000 stirring around on the streets nearby. Wonderful, wonderful happening.
And then, of course, you say that the elegant horse-drawn carriages escorted by Royal Canadian Mounted Police bring the governor to the hill.
Yes, the Governor General is brought to the hill and is the kind of the patron of honor of the celebration that day, and she is only one of many dignitaries that come. Of course, the Prime Minister and many cabinet ministers and many other famous entertainment stars and others also show up. Not to mention people like you and me.
Well, now I understand that Ottawa was not the first choice for the capital. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Back in the 1850s, the capital of the then the colony of Canada was actually shared by three cities, Montreal, Toronto, and Kingston. And each year, it rotated from one place to the other. You can imagine the you know, the turmoil that caused, and moving all the archives and records and politicians each year from one city to another. So finally, Queen Victoria put an end to all this and chose one of them, and they're all expecting one of the big three to be chosen. But in order, I guess, not to hurt the feelings of the losers, Ottawa was chosen, and it was just a tiny little rundown
frontier settlement,
barely that, you know. It was a totally. I guess everybody felt it was a disastrous choice, but that it started the great Canadian tradition of compromise.
and I guess at that point, when they started building all of these Gothic structures, there must have been some comments about whether it made any sense or not. I should think.
Oh, absolutely. The Gothic buildings were wonderful, big, majestic, soaring buildings, and here they were in this rough and tumble little lumber town,
right.
You know, that had dirt streets, brothels, and taverns, and in fact, the one person summed it up very beautifully when he said that Ottawa is a small town with incongruously beautiful buildings crowning its insignificance.
And you go on to say that someone said that these buildings have been described as the finest pile of stones in Canada.
Yes. The buildings are absolutely magnificent, Roy. You have to be there, and you can spend hours and hours just wandering around the hill looking at this wonderful Gothic structures. You know, they soar heavenward, so that there's really a kind of a majestic, almost religious feeling about them. And yet, on the other hand, they're very light and whimsical in some ways. There's very little symmetry. There's kind of an overall large-scale symmetry. But when you look in detail, there's all sorts of lack of symmetry and actually whimsy to it. I mean, some of the archways and doors have just got one arch after another piled on top of each other. So, you know, it almost looks like a bishop's hat or something
right.
Like that.
I saw the photos. Absolutely fabulous photos. And of course, we hear the buildings also reflect the British tradition of Parliament, right?
Yes. It's very much designed on the British system. In fact, the British Parliament buildings are also done in the Gothic style. And the Canadian parliamentary system is designed right after that. It has dozens and dozens of absolutely arcane, weird traditions built into it. Like, you know, the sergeant of arms is actually the person that enforces order in the buildings. And he wears a three-corner hat, a tricorn hat. He carries a big mace around, a golden mace, and things like that. And it goes on and on like that.
Well, let's just go through the buildings. The major buildings, what, there are three?
Well, actually, there's four. There's three main blocks, of which center block is the main one. And it's six stories high,
right.
A huge tower called the Peace Tower in front of it. And it houses both the House of Commons and the Senate chambers. On each side of it, flanking it at right angles, so it forms kind of the three sides of a quadrangle, are the East and West Block. These were originally built to house the entire civil service of Canada. Now I think it takes about 3,000 buildings to house them all, but they were optimistic in those days.
Exactly.
And behind the center block is the library. The library is kind of a circular design with flying buttresses and a large peak at the top, and is considered to be the finest building in Canada. It's architecturally,
right.
It's absolutely magnificent, inside and out. It's beautiful inside as well.
Now, so there's the Peace Tower,
mm-hmm.
And you're saying that your favorite is the... Now, just going back to the Peace Tower, they say it's been called the holiest place on Canadian soil because of the it commemorates those who died in the First World War. I think
the Peace Tower itself is tall and slender, and it has a number of things in it, including a carillon, which is but also it has in it the memorial chamber, which commemorates not only the end of the First World War, but all the wars prior to that as well.
That have come, yeah.
Yeah, and of course the Peace Tower was built. Because the center block burnt down during the First World War. So it was rebuilt just during the end and just after the First World War. So it was a time of great suffering and sadness for all the men lost and all the lives lost during the wars. So that particular chamber is very touching. Just absolutely touching and moving to be in there.
You go on to say that that your favorite is the East Block.
Yes.
Why is that?
The East Block is a bizarre building in a wonderful way. It's been really well preserved from the original days. It not only houses four special rooms that have been totally reconstructed in the era of the 1860s, including the Privy Council, the Cabinet Chamber, beautifully reconstructed rooms. But down below in the basements, when I was auditing and inspecting these places, I discovered down there there's old vaults that are no longer used, but some of the remnants of the doors of the vaults and some of the bars and grates are still down there. And they used to house all the gold bullion that passed through Canada. It was kind of what the Bank of Canada in the old days.
Like our Fort Knox.
Something like that, yeah. And during the Second World War, for example, all of the payments in gold that Britain made to the United States to pay for the arms and munitions came through Canada and were stored down in that basement. So billions of dollars worth of gold passed through that place. You know,
amazing.
I can imagine the stories and the ghosts would tell about that place.
Yeah, and is this where they had the stone carvings, the gargoyles, and all of that? Or?
Well, the stone carvings are one of my favorite things about the hill, and they're actually all through all of the buildings and decorate the outsides and insides of all the buildings.
Right.
You know, Roy, that they actually have had all through history of these buildings an official carver. He's called, his title is a Dominion Sculptor, and he or she has a staff of trained carvers, and they carve and are continuously adding more and more stone carvings to the buildings. And some of them are just delightful.
And stained glass windows and you know, those sorts of things. And it's terrific. Now, you did a book on the hill, didn't you? How'd you come about doing that?
Well, Roy, I'm glad you asked me. That really was one of the highlights of my career. I had so much fun. I was actually, my other business, my other career other than writing is being an environmental a scientist and an environmental consultant. And I was hired to do environmental audits of the Parliament buildings, actually on three different occasions.
How terrific.
It was wonderful. I got, because of my job, I had to inspect every nook and cranny in the buildings, you know, in case there was asbestos or PCBs or bad chemicals or things like that.
Right.
And so I climbed up every single tower. I went up every turret. I went inside every closet. I went down every tunnel. And the place is riddled with tunnels underneath. Very fascinating place. There's lots of ghosts on the hill, believe me, Roy.
A little spooky. Did you have somebody holding your hand, or did you do this on your own?
I pretty well did it by myself. I was escorted most times by some of their technical and mechanical people.
Right, people, yeah, exactly.
I'll tell you, it was scary. And fascinating. But in addition to that, I wrote I got permission from the authorities to have pretty well free access to the buildings and the people inside. So I got to interview the Dominion sculptor, the Dominion musician who plays the carillon, the chef that cooks for the politicians.
How wonderful.
And yeah, for 2 years I had unlimited run of the building. I had a pass, I could just go in and out. You know, those are the security paranoia that came in with 9/11. So it was a wonderful time of my life.
And the book is called Exploring the Hill, A Guide to Canada's Parliament, Past and Present.
Yes, it is, Roy.
That's terrific.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun writing that book. That really was just a fabulous experience and a wonderful time.
Now, so although the hill is a special place for all seasons, as you had, but for you, the very best moment comes on July 1st, Canada Day.
Yes, it does.
Hans, that's absolutely terrific. Great article for those listening and or those have access to their computer while they're listening. You can go to Destination Canada and bring up Hans's article with some absolutely spectacular photos of these buildings we've just talked about. Hans, thank you very much, and we wish you a happy and prosperous New Year. And we look forward to your next visit.
Okay, Roy. Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, talking travel with you, and all the best for the new year to you, too.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Hans Tamamagi, always a great story, always an interesting gentleman, and we hope to have him back soon. Let's see where we're at here. Next week, we're going to do a pre-recorded show, so I can't tell you who the guests will be because there won't be any. And you can always check out our program schedule by going to ttrn.com for the latest guest information. So this is Roy Lowy wishing everyone a happy and prosperous New Year, and Dr. Sullivan.
I had a great time, Roy. I now know how to pack when I buy my boat to go on the Great Circle and stop off to see Canada.
Well, that's not bad for a day, is it?
It was a great day. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure. And this is Roy Lowy once again saying we'll see you soon.
Lowy and friends on the Travel Talk Radio Network. Visit our website at ttrn.com for complete show archives and interviews with guests like Chris Elliott, Peter Greenberg, Bob Fisher, Johnny Jett, and many other great travel professionals. Don't forget to tune in live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern for more Talking Travel with Roy Lowy and friends.
In downtown St. Pete on New Year's Eve. We'll start with that smooth tune from Marion Meadows, his new one. This is called Suede. On Smooth Jazz, WSJT 94.1.